that lines, Yemen warns of further attacks on Saudi Arabia following a major drone and ballistic missile strike on the 6th anniversary of the Saudi-led war. Germany's top health official says the country's third wave of coronavirus pandemic could be worse than the previous ones. And also, at least 32 people are killed after two trains collide in Egypt. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour, the Yemeni army says it has launched a major drone and ballistic missile attack on Saudi Arabia.
National Day of Resilience operation targeted vital Saudi military headquarters and installations. It was carried out with 18 drones and 8 ballistic missiles. Aramco oil facilities in Ras Hanura, Rabigh, Jizan, Yanbu, and King Abdulaziz base in Dammam were targeted. Armed forces also targeted military sites in Najran and Asir with Qassem 2K drones. National Day of Resilience operation successfully achieved its goals. We warn the Saudi-led aggression of consequences of continuing its attacks and blockade of Yemen. We affirm our readiness to carry out more military operations in the future.
The Saudi Defense Ministry has confirmed the Yemeni attack on an oil products distribution station in Jizan. The ministry said it will take action to protect its oil exports. The latest attacks by the Yemeni army come on the 6th anniversary of the Saudi invasion of the country. The Yemeni army, backed by Ansarullah forces, has conducted similar attacks in the past. They say they are in retaliation for Riyadh's war that has so far claimed tens of thousands of lives in Yemen. Political commentator Tim Anderson says Saudi Arabia has failed to achieve any of its objectives in Yemen in the past 6 years.
The Saudis are clearly acting as the agent of the US here. Let's not be under any illusion that they are some independent force there. They are a tiny puppet regime, basically, that has a lot of oil money. It was able to buy a lot of weapons, but they are serving the interests of Washington in its plan for a new Middle East to wipe out all of the independent political will, the political states in the region, basically, and the Ansarullah-led government in Sana'a is one of the things that was very inconvenient to them. And, of course, Israel is also involved in this operation along with the Emiratis. So the Saudis, as the spearhead of that, if you like, have not achieved any of their objectives. They've been on retreat for some time now, and as your report points out, that's the Yemenis are pressing their advantage now that they have the upper hand. When talk about Yemen, let's remember it's not simply Ansarullah. Ansarullah created a very large coalition. Most of the Yemeni army defected to this coalition government, and it's had very strong popular support. So we shouldn't be under no illusions, even though the Western governments continue to maintain that a man under in-house detention in Riyadh is the president of Yemen. We should be under no illusion that there is quite a strong government with a strong public backing there, and despite the siege, they've demonstrated that they're able to resist and they're able to press their advantage.
Yemenis have staged rallies to mark the 6th anniversary of the Saudi-led war on their country. The rallies took place in the capital Sana'a, the northern city of Saada, and the western port of Hodeidah. They were held on the occasion of the National Day of Resilience against the Saudi-led aggression. A statement issued by organizers said that people won't allow the blood of their compatriots to be wasted. The statement also stressed that the Yemenis reserve the right to pursue criminals and punish them. Apart from its military campaign, Saudi Arabia has also imposed a sea and air blockade on Yemen. The UN says the impoverished Arab nation is facing the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Elsewhere, Germany's top health official says there are clear signals that the country's third wave of the coronavirus could be worse than the first two.
There are clear signals that this wave could become significantly worse than the first two waves. We must prepare for the number of cases rising strongly and that more people get seriously ill again, that hospitals will get overburdened and that a lot of people will die. We're just at the beginning of this development. And if we don't massively countersteer immediately, the consequences will be grave.
The health official also warned that the number of new infections could rise to 100,000 in a day if the spread of the virus is not curbed. Wheeler urged people to stay at home over Easter, warning that Germany will have very difficult weeks ahead. During a press conference, Health Minister Jens Spahn also warned that the health system could reach its limit in April. The number of new confirmed infections in Germany has jumped. In recent weeks, the country has registered more than 72,000 deaths out of over 2.7 million infections. EU leaders have stopped short of introducing a ban on the export of COVID-19 vaccines produced in the 27-nation bloc. This is while new data shows just over 4% of people living in the EU have been fully vaccinated. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
EU leaders have concluded the first of a two-day virtual summit, which was dominated by the bloc's highly controversial COVID-19 vaccination program. It was confirmed during the event that more vaccines have been exported from the EU than have been administered to the bloc's own inhabitants.
Companies have to honour their contract to the European Union before they export to other regions in the world.
So the EU's ban on vaccine exports, when deemed necessary, is going ahead. But critics say the damage has already been done due to the European Commission's mismanagement to date. The leaders' summit was given official data showing just 4.1% of the EU's population have been fully vaccinated. A third wave of the coronavirus is taking hold in the 27-nation bloc. Cases are spiking, most notably in France, Poland, Italy, and Germany. Infection rate increases are being recorded in several other EU nations, including here in Belgium.
This means hospital admissions are rising. More are being transferred to intensive care units. The bottom line is people are dying due to the pace of the EU's vaccination rollout programme.
There's economic disaster looming for millions of businesses in the EU as new lockdowns are announced. In some nations, jobs are being lost at a record rate. The tourism industry is on its knees. Citizens are frustrated.
Our government was telling that it would be better in May and the opening of the cafes, restaurants and so on. And nowadays, I don't dare make a plan.
For the moment, the situation is so difficult that everybody's complaining about everything. And I understand that. It's not easy.
Critics say the health, social and economic consequences of the EU's failures during this crisis are not yet fully clear. Analysts warn there are likely to be dire political consequences for the establishment. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
China has imposed sanctions against more than a dozen British companies and individuals, accusing them of spreading lies about the situation of Uyghur Muslims. Beijing says the measure is in response to a similar move by London over alleged human rights abuses against Uyghurs. For more on that, we're joined earlier by our guests to discuss the issue in our news review program.
Welcome to this hour's news review. China has imposed sanctions on more than a dozen British companies and individuals for what it called spreading lies about the situation of its Muslim Uyghur minority. Five British lawmakers, including former Conservative Party leader Ian Duncan Smith, are among those sanctioned. All of the sanctioned parties will be barred from Chinese territory, while their property will be frozen there. Also, Chinese citizens and institutions will be banned from doing business with them. China says the measures are in response to the UK sanctions over alleged human rights abuses against Uyghurs.
The UK imposed unilateral sanctions on relevant Chinese individuals and entities, citing the so-called human rights issues in Xinjiang. This move, based on nothing but lies and disinformation, flagrantly breaches international law and basic norms governing international relations, grossly interferes in China's internal affairs, and severely undermines China-UK relations.
China said it is firmly determined to safeguard its national sovereignty and security. It warned of further measures if Britain goes further down the wrong path. The U.S. and the EU, as well as Canada, have also imposed sanctions on China over alleged human rights violations against Uyghurs in Xinjiang. China has rejected the allegations, saying its camps in the region offer vocational training. Well, I'll be discussing this with guests who join me this hour, the first one of whom will be our correspondent in London, Amina Taylor, who joins us via Skype. Amina, tell me, what's the word on the street regarding this latest development between China and the UK?
Just to get some perspectives of what the British response to this has been, we've had Minister Boris Johnson saying that he supported those who had been sanctioned. Ian Duncan Smith, the most high profile of the group that you mentioned in that introduction, said he would wear this sanction as a badge of honor, which incidentally was pretty much along the lines of what the Chinese representative said on Monday after the EU and the UK had announced their own punishment, their own sanctions. The tying of any noose, any political noose that would engender cooperation and closer diplomatic ties seems to be getting smaller and smaller. And unfortunately, I think this is the beginning of something and not necessarily the end, unfortunately.
And on that beginning, of course, I'm going to ask you my second question, perhaps. Fabrizio Goldini, political analyst out of Hong Kong, is joining us via Skype. Mr. Goldini, it's good to see you as well. Tell me what you think about this recent development that has happened between China and the UK.
This is something that is the continuation of the policy that we want basically to destabilize the Xinjiang region. Okay. So if we wanted to enter in the sanction, how they work and this kind of things, yes, I mean, we can do it. So basically, they block this dozen of British companies and individuals from entering the Chinese territories, they frozen the assets, and especially they ban the Chinese institution and citizen by doing business, you know, with this one. But is something that is something that is evolving, you know, because in this moment, for example, there is a lot of tensions because some multinational companies they make a statement about the forced labor allegation in Xinjiang in the cotton industry. So you know, it's something that is an episode. You know, every some time they come with new things. So in my opinion, we have to ask, you know, why they wanted to destabilize the Xinjiang, you know? And so I would like to reply to this question. I say, basically, it's a matter of strategic importance of Xinjiang. First of all, is the Belt and Road Initiative. Second is the control of the cotton market. It is very, very important. China is the main producer of cotton. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Number three, I want to say, it is the creation of a fake news in order to, fake news about the relationship with the Muslim community. Mm-hmm. So they want to spread in the world the point that China is against the Muslim. That is exactly the opposite. These are the points that, in my opinion, I would like to comment today.
Many, many thanks, Mr. Fabrizio Goldini, political analyst out of Hong Kong. I really like to appreciate the time my good friend Amina Taylor also gave us out of London. She's our correspondent in that part of the world. I really appreciate it, both of you.
The train crash in southern Egypt has left more than 30 people dead and scores more injured. The incident took place when two passenger trains collided in the city of Sohag. Railway authorities say emergency brakes were triggered by unknown individuals and caused the first train to stop while the other one hit it from behind. A couple of carriages derailed above a channel of water. According to the health ministry, 32 people have been killed and 91 injured. President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi mourned the victims and pledged to punish those responsible. The northeastern African country has been plagued with deadly train accidents that have been widely blamed on inadequate infrastructure and poor maintenance. Political chaos in Israel. Another general election has failed to produce a clear path to a parliamentary majority. The Israeli premier is facing an uncertain political future.
Israel appears to be in the midst of another political deadlock after its fourth general election in less than 2 years. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who's become Israel's longest-serving prime minister after 12 years in power, had hoped that this week's election would give him another term. He tried hard to unite a right-wing coalition behind him, but apparently that has not happened. The 71-year-old's right-wing bloc has once again failed to secure enough votes for a parliamentary majority. His bloc is 9 seats short of a necessary 61-seat threshold. It is now far from clear who would get the mandate to form the next cabinet. If he wants to stay in power, Netanyahu will probably have to build a coalition involving Jewish ultra-Orthodox and ultra-nationalist parties. Netanyahu may even have to seek the support of a Palestinian party, which in a surprise development has managed to win several seats. Meanwhile, Netanyahu's opponents, who could somehow reach a parliamentary majority, are far from united and are unlikely to be able to agree to cooperate. It is still too soon to know whether this election will prove to be inconclusive. If neither bloc succeeds, Israel could be headed for a fifth general election since 2019. Some analysts believe the regime is experiencing its worst political crisis in decades.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had invested heavily in this week's election. Many described his path a dangerous gambit. With the emerging stalemate, the Israeli premier, who's being tried on corruption charges, faces an uncertain political future.
The Israeli Prime Minister is in deep trouble because this week's election was widely viewed as a referendum on his leadership. Netanyahu's election campaign focused on his much-talked-about COVID-19 vaccination program and his push to normalize ties with some Arab states. But his opponents insist he mishandled the pandemic. Meanwhile, they argue that he should not remain in office while being tried on corruption charges. Netanyahu is the first incumbent Israeli prime minister to be indicted after being formally charged with corruption. He has denied any wrongdoing and insists that he will not try to block the trial. But critics are not buying that. They suspect that if he finally forms a parliamentary majority, he may seek action at the Knesset to delay or end the legal process.
If he can form a coalition government, he will certainly appoint someone as the attorney general who will quash the corruption charges against them. So, I mean, it's not simply the question of forming a government for him. It's a question for him of staying out of prison, because let's face it, Israeli police have been after him for some time, and they have enough evidence.
Meanwhile, as Israeli political parties wrangle over how to proceed from this point, Palestinians in the occupied territories are showing less interest in Israeli politics. This is perhaps because the Palestinian issue was not mentioned much during electoral campaigns by Israeli parties. The regime has been demolishing Palestinian homes, seizing their lands, and building on them over the past decades.
We're going to continue to see exactly what we have been seeing over the past years, and that is the continuation of settlement expansion, the ousting of Palestinians from East Jerusalem, the continued dispossession of the Bedouin in the Negev.
This has been an unchanging policy, and no new cabinet is expected to halt that.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Noruz special. The message of spring is to tell human beings that he's not less than nature. As nature awakens, we humans too should wake up from negligence and abandon grudges and deep-rooted complexes to purify our souls. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, said, "He who does not become aware from the change of the world is among the most negligent people." Spring is a valuable means to lead humans towards cognizance of God and worship of God. Spring is a manifestation of God's power. The spirit of spring is the spirit of monotheism, contemplation and refreshment. Spring teaches the lesson of completion and perfection. Spring is a product of a creator who revives nature with his infinite power. Spring is a great sign of God to attract our attention to the world, which is developing every moment. Spring and the Nowruz convey the message of rebirth for mankind, and nature is a small picture of resurrection, which is shown to mankind every year. There are myriads of signs of resurrection in nature. There are many verses in the Noble Quran which point to this reality. For example, verse 9 of Surah Fatir, for instance, reads, "And it is Allah who sends the winds, and they raise a cloud. Then we drive it towards a dead land, and with it revive the earth after its death. Likewise will be the resurrection." The verses which point to the revival of nature refer to its thriving in spring after the cold winter. But the depth of these verses indicates that God tries to awaken us and make us heedful of our fate. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, says, "Whenever you see spring, remember the resurrection and your death a lot." Spring changes nature and opens the eyes of trees and flowers towards light and warmth. We too should try to clean our soul to get warmth of love and affection, to sympathize with fellow human beings and be thoughtful of their pains and sufferings. Spring gives us the opportunity to learn from nature. Generosity, affection, kindness, and altruism are the lessons that can be acquired from nature. As a matter of fact, generosity is among the characteristics that prevail in spring. Everyone tries to share his happiness with others. It is narrated that once, during the Eid al-Fitr, or the Feast of Fasting, Muslim women donated their bracelets and earrings to the Prophet of Islam, to be spent for the poor and the destitute. The Almighty says in verse 7 of Surah Ibrahim in the Holy Quran, "And when your Lord proclaimed, 'If you are grateful, I will surely enhance you in blessings.'" Moreover, the Holy Quran stresses that the faithful should donate what they like in order to reach goodness. Verse 92 of Surah Al Imran reads, "You will never attain piety until you spend out of what you hold dear. The message of spring for mankind is to know that human being is no less than nature, so it is a matter of shame to be negligent of the divine bounties and spend a life in ignorance and heedlessness. We can make every day Nowruz, a new day, through generosity, visiting relatives and being kind to others. The first infallible successor of the Prophet of Islam, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, says, any day on which God is not disobeyed is Eid or feast. This shows that what matters is to keep aloof from sin and to obey God Almighty. Every sin makes us distant from our innate nature and divine essence. Spring is the loveliest of seasons, but the real spring of hearts and souls will come when the Savior of mankind, Imam Mahdi, may God hasten his reappearance, reappears from behind the curtain of occultation. That is why he is called Rabi'ul Anam, or the spring of all the peoples. There are many narrations which recommend the faithful to be mindful and in remembrance of Imam Mahdi in Nowruz. Spring is a revival of nature, whilst Imam Mahdi, may God hasten his reappearance, is the spring of the entire creation. Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace be upon him, says, there is no Nowruz except we, the progeny of the Prophet, wait for the reappearance of Imam Mahdi on it, because Nowruz is among our days and the days of our Shias. In another narration, Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace be upon him, says, Nowruz is the day on which the Qa'im of us, the Ahlul Bayt, will reappear. Spring has come to insert love and affection in hearts and empty them from grudges and hostilities. It has come to clothe the hearts and souls with new garments. It has come to adorn hearts with godly merits. Spring is the season of renewal, of regeneration, revision, and refreshment. It is a good chance to rethink, to reset, to replan, to rearrange, and to restore.
We give people.
Kids at the U.S. border.
A record number of children are arriving at the U.S.-Mexico border without their parents. Unaccompanied immigrant children are streaming into the United States by crossing the border, raising concerns about human rights as well as security, both inside the country and abroad. Daily apprehension of children is spinning out of control. Many are kept in camps that were not made for children, in conditions not clear for everyone.
What should happen to those children who are making this trip?
Stop them before they get here. Because how many children won't make the trip? Why don't we stop that before it starts?
Hello and welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Mila Javamadi. The Biden administration is trying to deter immigrants, refugees, and asylum seekers, mostly escaping violence in South and Central America, from entering the U.S. However, he is allowing some unaccompanied minors to enter. The record influx of people has created a rare opportunity for human smuggling gangs. Unfortunately, this is a dark and sad story. But please stay with us as we shed light on this very important issue.
If the parents are in Central America living in poverty, how can they get to Mexico? That's why so many children are fleeing in the first place, because they see the poverty that their parents live in.
The crisis at the border is a telltale of human rights situation in the United States. Putting kids in cages or the so-called migrant facilities shows the depth of U.S. politicians' disregard for children who actually never chose to enter the country on their own.
The Biden administration, along with the Mexican government, needs to disrupt the cartels that are frankly the only ones benefiting from the situation as it currently stands. And then here in the U.S., the Biden administration needs to stand up the infrastructure in terms of facilities, the processes, and then ultimately the capacity so that these children can go through a process that's safe, legal, and humane.
Politicizing the issue and taking advantage of the influx is now on the agenda of many seeking to consolidate their grip on power. Biden's nemesis, namely congressional Republicans, argue that he is ignoring the crisis, pretending that a Republican president like Trump would have performed better.
In reality, Biden has ended the Trump-era practice of expelling immigrant children, but maintained expulsions of immigrant families and single adults. Our first guest today is Todd Miller. Mr. Miller, the United States promotes itself as a protector of human rights across the world. Yet today, unaccompanied children are the most vulnerable victims of the influx at the border. How do you assess the administration's performance in regard to human rights amid the situation at the southern border?
Yeah, I would say that the border itself is designed to be a human rights violation. So it doesn't matter who arrives to the U.S. southern border, in this case, unaccompanied minors. The very way of the kind of enforcement apparatus that's been developed over many, many, many years, by its very design, it forces people into really vulnerable places. It stops people from being able to cross borders. It incarcerates people. And in its very essence, it's a human rights violation. And so, so it contradicts this idea of like what is going on the border now, or what's been going on the border, you know, a year ago, or what's been going on the U.S. southern border for decades. Actually, it's a constant a human rights abuse to the people trying to cross the border. And so that kind of contradicts this idea of the United States being this kind of global messenger of human rights.
Todd Miller, journalist and author of Border Patrol Nation, many thanks for your input.
The new spike in the number of crossings amounts to tragedy for many families and children. For the Biden administration, it has different implications, including partial bending of the law. The Customs and Border Protection would normally receive unaccompanied children first, until the Department of Health and Human Services can provide enough space to accept them in one of their shelters.
Why is it more humane to take these kids, to put them in Border Patrol facilities that were not meant for children, oftentimes for many more days than the legal limit?
Chris, that is not what the prior administration did. You'll forgive me. The prior administration did expel children, did fly children to countries from which they were fleeing, countries that did not have the capacity to administer asylum claims, countries that suffer tremendous violence, poverty, corruption, and other infirmities. So to suggest that the prior administration handled the needs of children in a humane way is just false.
The maximum amount of time a child is legally supposed to be held in Border Patrol custody is 72 hours, but thousands of unaccompanied children had been held in custody for longer, with 2,226 being held for more than 5 days and 823 being held for more than 10 days, according to some reports. We're now joined by Mr. Lima Roca. Mr. Roca, how did we get here?
I do think that the structure of anti-policy, anti-immigration policies, it started in Obama administration when President Barack Hussein, he exposed more or less to 500 to 600,000 people every year. So Trump radicalized his speech, radicalized his policies, and Biden, or he cannot dismantle this, or he will preserve this to, I would say hello to Texan Republicans because he needs their support.
Thank you, Bruno Lima Roca, Professor of International Studies. Stay tuned for more.
Early summer is usually the peak of the migrants' arrival. With the steep rise in the number of detentions, more asylum seekers are expected to arrive. Relaxation of enforcement at the border is denied by authorities. However, it plays a major role in the rise.
There are a lot of kids who come without their parents, and many arrive without anything at all because they've been robbed along the way. I even had to share a room with one who was from Guatemala. They put him with us so he wouldn't cry so much, because so many of them cry when their parents don't come for them. It's terrible to see.
It's fair.
Two major hurricanes last year, as well as the coronavirus pandemic, have made it impossible for many to stay in their home countries of Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, and Mexico. On the other hand, the situation is adding more stress to the U.S. system and overwhelming the country's resources, which had already been strained due to the COVID-19 pandemic. What role do hurricanes and the pandemic play, and what should the Biden administration do?
What the Biden administration needs to do is probably look at a number of things. The kind of enforcement that makes children vulnerable at our border needs to be addressed. The reasons why people are coming in the first place. For example, right now, a number of people that are coming from Honduras particularly are saying that the hurricanes, and if you remember, there was two catastrophic Category 4 hurricanes that hit the Honduran and Nicaraguan coasts in 2020. Those hurricanes caused huge devastation and displacement, and a lot of people are saying that's one of the reasons why. So you have a climate situation, right? And some of the people that are coming up at this point, and then you look at how the United, you know, if that's the case, then how do you deal with climate change? That would be the sort of questions you would have to why so many people are coming, why so many children are coming. But what seems to be the course of action in the United States, and it doesn't even matter what party it is to continue to do the border enforcement. So by no means with the Biden administration is the border open, right? There's this kind of narrative playing out in the media at this point saying, oh, there's an open border. There is not.
The evolving situation on the U.S.-Mexico border comes with reports of kids who have not seen sunlight in days, and others often going days without taking showers. Some of the kids sleep in bunk beds, some of them three bunks high. Still better than overcrowded facilities and children sleeping on the ground.
What they're hearing is that you can now come into the United States, which you can as a kid, and so they're going to keep coming. And the problem here is that the Biden administration on day one made about a half dozen changes, and since then have made several more that encourage more people to come to the border, and they didn't put anything in place to deal with it. Either another policy to discourage people from coming, which the president says he wants to do, or to put the preparations in place, including the shelters and the holding facilities that have been so criticized, and I saw some of them the other day. Kids are overcrowded. They're in situations you would never want your kid to be in.
There are also sponsors for the children, typically a family member in the U.S., who has to be located so that their identity and relationship to the child is verified. Meanwhile, the uptick of the unaccompanied children presenting themselves at the border remains a political matter. But how do the children feel?
The keeping children in custody is terrible for the children. It's been shown time and time again. Infamously, during the Trump administration, particularly during the 2018 zero tolerance policy that the Trump administration implemented, the world could see like what was happening with children, the sort of things that happened in detention, even the abuses by the U.S. Border Patrol. But those sorts of things have been happening for a long time. There's a report by the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, from that looked at short-term Border Patrol detention effects on kids from 2009 to 2014. So mind you, that's the President Barack Obama years.
The highly politicized influx of children is contributing to the power play underway in the United States. High-ranking Republicans rush to blame particularly the Biden administration for the crisis. The administration's response has basically been, we're doing all we can.
In the first 2.5 months of this year, they've made about 110,000 apprehensions. Including in those apprehensions are 800 criminal aliens who have previously been arrested and exported from the United States, 78 sex offenders, and 62 gang members.
At the same time, the administration is trying to send a message to the future refugees, asking them not to come to the U.S. The GOP, meanwhile, considers the Biden administration a big welcome sign to all the migrants seeking to enter through the Mexico border. Political steam has been building for 2 months since President Biden tackled some of Trump's harsh border policies. But the history of U.S. aggression towards Central America is older than that.
The Reagan administration and Bush father administration, they almost neutralized all the opposition in Central America. They occupied El Salvador, they occupied Honduras, they almost occupied Guatemala, and they attacked Nicaragua. So the social crisis in Central America is a fruit of U.S. policies during the 80s. That's a fact. So Republicans must be proud of what's happening now, because they promoted this terror in the 80s.
The crisis at the border gave former President Trump an opportunity to promote his own immigration policies. Trump said he proudly gave secure borders to Biden despite the current situation. Trump suggested that he created a smooth running system on autopilot, which Biden has now broken.
This is a respite shelter in McAllen, Texas, near the U.S.-Mexican border. All of the people here, families and young children, arrived recently in the United States, many of them crossing the Rio Grande River with their families. They were apprehended by Border Patrol and sent to a detention center nearby. And then they come here for processing. This group here arrived in the morning. They'll get all their papers processed. They've all had COVID tests, and if they're negative, they're allowed to come to this shelter. For a few nights, maybe 1 or 2 days, this group over here has stayed here. They will move on to family members or sponsor families in the United States. But clearly, the numbers are surging here.
Trump's anti-immigration policy was a centerpiece of his 2016 election campaign and is now a major issue as he seeks re-election. As the U.S. president, he promised to build a wall on the U.S. border with Mexico to physically stop the inflow of migrants, but failed to fulfill that pledge. So what can Biden do, and will it make a difference?
Biden claims that he's going to reunite families who are separated under the Trump administration. He's going to review, if not reverse, what is known as the Remain in Mexico program, which has people who come to the U.S. border looking for asylum. It makes them wait on the other side of the border in Mexico, and there's been all kinds of problems with that. So on that level, Biden's policies almost seem revolutionary, in a sense, to Trump. On another level, and this is the level that I do want to speak to, they're very much the same. If you look at the U.S. border, it's been under a certain strategy now for 25 years.
During a similar record influx of unaccompanied minors in 2014, the Obama administration dispatched FEMA for help, something the Biden administration is resorting to as well. But violation of the non-Americans' rights is nothing new.
Children are only supposed to be in Border Patrol custody long enough for them to be processed, put into the system, booked in, if you will, and then moved on to HHS shelters. So that workforce right now, unfortunately, are stressed out, overwhelmed, and it's backed up. They have to get these facilities right. They have to move these children into HHS custody in 72 hours, and they're not able to do that because we are encouraging, as a country right now, we're encouraging people to send or bring a child to the border because you're getting a free pass, essentially, right? That's what happened in 2014.
Biden's failure to handle the situation is being heard loud and clear by human smugglers and those in search of supposedly better life in Central America. Crisis at the U.S. southern border is the tip of the iceberg, as many kids are already being detained by the Mexican government, never getting the chance to arrive at the U.S. border. There are also the human smugglers. What is your take on the human trafficking business reportedly booming these days across the U.S.-Mexico border?
Human trafficking and drug dealing in Central America and Mexico, it's a huge business, huge business. It wouldn't be operating without the commit and the corruption of Mexican authorities, but also it wouldn't be occurring without the complacency and the control, the coordination of U.S. agencies. It's just like DEA. You can't even imagine to worldwide drug dealing without DEA administrating it, controlling the cartels, opposing one cartel against the other, and eventually making profit of it.
Every child's story at the border is a unique one, but with a big portion of similarities. The kids are victims of the adults' behavior and decision-making. Deprived of compassion and the presence of their families, they enter a new environment with a new language and new faces.
One of the challenges we knew early on, what are the numbers, what's the intel look like? I think that's part of the reason why FEMA was asked to step in, is to help speed this process up. Allow the agencies to get caught up with the children, and then build a system that would then be able to surge and move faster through the system.
The children with pressing needs must not be considered intruders. Living under the U.S. Border Patrol custody must be intolerable, especially for the really small children. Contending with the widening emergency that Biden team views as a stressful challenge rather than a crisis has been challenging for the young administration. Is it a crisis or not, and regardless of the terminology, are Republicans taking advantage of this?
They're taking on the new administration for sure. It seems like the Republicans are just looking for any sort of weakness on, and in a way, manufacturing a crisis. Like, by using the word crisis, they're saying that there's open borders with the Biden administration, which is patently not true. So, it seems like this is a key point for the Republicans. That was a huge central foundational point of the Donald Trump administration during his campaigns.
Overcrowding and harsh conditions in federal facilities have to be addressed. The administration is accused of hiding the reality of the situation by not allowing media to show specific places. Can the power-hungry steer clear of the politics and just act in favor of children?
They're 15, 16, 17 years old, all from Guatemala. They say they took 2, 3, 4 weeks to get to the United States. We asked them if they had any idea about the changes in the Biden administration in terms of policy for unaccompanied minors coming to the U.S. They said they had no idea. They said that they were coming to the United States because they wanted a better life for themselves, and it was too dangerous in Guatemala.
The president is scrambling to manage the growing humanitarian and political challenge, which could end up undermining his legislative agenda. The surge in border crosses is reportedly troubling the administration as the country's facilities keep working beyond capacity. Is it a crisis or not? Some are still discussing that. And can the Biden administration handle it? Mr. Miller, your take. What should be done to address the roots of the problem?
But from the United States perspective, when you look at Central America, you have to look at U.S. policy in Central America. You have to look at U.S. militarization in Central America. You have to look at even historic support, the U.S. supporting of dictatorships in Central America. You have to look at U.S. economic policy in Central America. You have to look at U.S. extractive industries in Central America and see how that influences how people are also being displaced. And when you like start getting to the root reasons, and when you see like a farmer who's marginalized or is poor can't make it, and then a drought hits that's climate induced, and those sorts of things, or a person's working in a U.S. factory that making under a livable wage, all those things are huge to the displacement. And when you deal with the displacement, you start dealing with all the branches of what people migrate under or are trafficked under. And it seems to me those are the sorts of issues that need to be addressed.
During his 2020 campaign days, the Democratic nominee had vowed to fix the country's broken immigration policy, something that is yet to materialize. Meanwhile, the situation appears to be getting out of control as the administration faces caravans of immigrants deemed illegal.
We're in the middle of a crisis on our southern border. The unprecedented surge of illegal migrants from Central America is harming both Mexico and the United States, and I believe the steps we will take, starting right now, will improve the safety in both of our countries. It's going to be very, very good for Mexico. A nation without borders is not a nation. Beginning today, the United States of America gets back control of its borders, gets back its borders.
The Trump administration cracked down on immigration more than any other administrations in recent history. But the Biden team is also refusing to acknowledge the depth of the crisis and secretly pursues the same agenda. That has put forth a record in detentions and expulsions, as well as a boom in human trafficking into the country. How the situation will pan out remains to be seen. Thank you for staying with us. I'm your host, Mila Javamardi. I'm looking forward to seeing you again next week on We the People.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.